Oh, yes, my friends. It's the Show and Sleeve Show.
Take my hat, take my coat, take my gloves, I'll take a cup. Take my money, but I'm begging, please don't take my shoe, my shoe. Take my house, take my clothes, take my wife, lighten up my load. Take my feet, you can take my toes, but please don't take my shoe.
From the downtowniest part of New York City, the city that never sleeps, the city that never weeps, the city where nothing keeps. Coming to you live on WCJD 90.2, New York, high atop the Empire State Building.
I was in the other set when the came around. I took an into the soul. And I have to listen. We're on a funicular, I believe. A gondola. We're headed straight up into the sky. I'll tell you, last week there was some difficulty that I had recording the show. I, as I do it live, I record it so that I can post it later, all that. Sean is sometimes around. He wasn't around last week. He's not around tonight. He'll be around sometime in the future. But as he was concerned that I might ruin another episode, not that it was completely ruined, we just missed some things, some little sections. Good, I think. I think it's good not to have it all. I appreciate mixed results. Why be completely successful all the time? In fact, I like the idea of some of the shows not getting, oh, it's very bumpy, not getting recorded. But anyway, he said, let's do this. I'm good. Let's show and proof the show. So you just press one button and then nothing else happens. So he set up an entire hour of sound that'll be in the background. Things that he said will trigger thoughts for me, I don't know. But he said I didn't have to do anything this evening. Leave it up to him. He'll create all these noises that will carry us along wherever it is that we're going at the moment, straight up into the sky. Now I've got the... I feel a bit like I'm sitting in the back seat of a possibly... one of those cars that's extremely long. It's not a limousine. Extremely long, non-limousine car. And I'm in a very far back seat and I'm trying to see if there's anyone driving. And all I know is that the vehicle is moving forward.
Hello, I'm Mike Lindell. I've invented the world's most comfortable pillow. I make them right here in the United States. Do not change that channel because the next half hour is going to change your life.
I'll tell you about this.
It took me a while just to get out of bed and rejuvenate myself again. But after having the MyPillow, I just feel so much better. Just everything is just well taken care of, it feels like.
It's a little embarrassing. I was over his house, and I occasionally like to watch this channel. I think it's called the Value Channel. Now, I think of it as a sociological interest. It's a channel which is just all commercials, infomercials for aerobics equipment, the latest fitness crazes, things to help with diet, machines that chop vegetables, and vitamin packages. And the latest one that I'm fascinated by is this pillow, my pillow. I've seen it 3 times now. And I... So he's put this in. I suppose he wants me to talk about it. He suggested I talk about it. I said, no, that's a bit embarrassing. I have to explain my relationship to the Value Channel and my pillow. And I didn't want to. And then... So now I am... So that's, so far, absent Sean, 1. Present Sherwin, 0. So, I don't know if you've ever seen these channels. And I'll try to tell you what my interest is in them. I think our gondola has arrived. Fentadu. Prison or a cave? Prison.
If you've answered yes to any of these questions, then you, like millions of other Americans, simply aren't getting a good night's sleep. My friend and sleep expert, Michael J. Lindell, is the founder and inventor of a revolutionary new sleep aid. Mike's here to share with us why getting a good night's sleep is the secret to a happy, healthy life.
Hi, Tanya.
Hi, Mike.
Well, it's not only the secret to a happy life, it's critical to your health. Mm. And like everybody else out there, I have used my arm, folded my pillows, got migraines in the morning from sleeping on poor pillows. And what it is, what I've found in my studies over the last 7 years, is the cervical nerves on each side of your neck need to be held straight in order to get that deep REM sleep that we all need. That's our healing sleep.
That's what I want.
Healing is critical to one's health. And pillows are the problem. There is no bigger problem than our pillows.
Mike, I hear what you're saying. According to the National Sleep Foundation, the average adult purchases 58 pillows over their lifetime. They own six different pillows at any given time, and this is what blew me away. 70% of us do not like our current pillow we sleep with every night.
And I don't like my pillow. I've never liked my pillow in my entire life. Now, I'm used to that. I've never liked my beds either. And I think it's a situation, it's a circumstance. You lie down in something for so long, no matter what it is, it's going to be... You can't have a perfect relationship with it. It's like a marriage. You're married to a series of mattresses and a series of pillows, but you have to spend so much time pressing yourself into them that you're bound to become uncomfortable, permanently uncomfortable, and yet still you'll always be there, pressing upon it, because you must. So, what I love about these programs is their artless but artful form of chicanery, how they push themselves on you, how they make themselves so vitally essential that even a skeptic, even someone, a hard-boiled non-purchaser like myself, will, after 30 minutes of watching such a thing, a MyPillow presentation that is quite clearly designed to deceive you into buying a MyPillow, that I, who...
What's going on here?
Well, I just happen to have some here. these pillows, the last 30 years, in the 1970s, pillows kind of changed forever. And we've all slept with this pillow here. This one here has ruined America. We've all slept on this. There's no support. This has done more for bad sleep deprivation than anything anywhere. And another thing too, and you wash these pillows, and you know how they ball up in a washer and dryer. The big pillow companies want you buying more and more pillows, and they don't care about your health. They don't care about our sleep. They don't care that we keep buying pillows over and over and over again. Yeah. I just wanted some sleep, and I did something about it. And this pillow here, I can't say enough bad things about it. Terrible.
Mike, I love your pillow.
Hotel Foxtrot. heard of that. Hotel.
Foxtrot.
So now... Now, I don't know if there's other noises will come up, so I have to stop when these other noises... There's a signal noise, that cello strike. That's when something, an announcement is coming, or some bit that he's put in. He told me that he would signal, he would give a signal sound, when I should be quiet. So I'm trying to follow that, if you're wondering. So the truth is that I watch these value shows, and without fail, by the end of every single one, I am on board 100%, looking for the phone that I may purchase, something that will strengthen my abdominals, some line of product, vitamins, and blue jars that will enhance all of the things that I want enhanced. And I will get a pillow that will help with my cervical vertebrae and will let me get into the deep REM sleep that I so desperately need, the deep healing sleep that Mike almost constantly talks about throughout the entire program. Deep REM healing sleep. These pillows have ruined America. The big pillow companies. Have you ever heard of the big pillow companies? I am not a fan of them. They are just about the worst that there could ever be. There's nothing even worse than the big pharmaceutical companies. It's the big pillow companies. They have done more to this country I can't even speak of it. It almost makes me sad. Now, honestly, even as doubtful as I am, and as curious, and as I think this is a sociological thing, I want to see how we get baited and tricked, how they can take someone like me and pull me so far across the divide, this great space. They'll tug me right to the furthest side, and I find myself to be the least convinced, the greatest resistant. No, I think this is the sound. No, it's not. But how someone like me could be taken, and if I can be taken, we all can be taken, and maybe we all should be taken and have the pills and the pillow and the abdominal strengthener and the punching exercise routines and the vegetable crusher.
This one here has ruined America. The big pillow companies want you buying more and more pillows, and they don't care about your health. They don't care about our sleep. They don't care that we keep buying pillows over and over and over again.
Pillows that just don't work. The pillow's broken.
People all across America are tired of tossing and turning all night, snoring like a freight train, and waking up with aches and pains from pillows that simply don't work.
My pillow. All the pillows I used to have are gone. My pillow.
Doing Andy?
Good. I met you at the State Fair last year.
Oh, yes, I remember.
And I didn't even know I was looking for a pillow. And you saw me and said, I need to talk to you. And I got to tell you, thanks. You know, it's changed my life. It's changed the way I sleep. I sleep, I think, is the big thing.
It's a miracle. With your big shoulders, there's a lot of people out here like you. You have all kinds of problems because of you.
And I'm a side sleeper. I've always been a side sleeper. The arm falls asleep.
Right.
Not anymore.
Not anymore. That's amazing, yeah.
So yes, I almost buy every single thing that I see. And I love how they call it my pillow, as though you have already purchased it. They could call it the pillow I've already purchased. The pillow that has already arrived and is in my bed. By a freighter across the water, cricket streams. So I wonder if you're like me. Do you find yourself skeptical and yet a sucker? What is that? How can we be both at the same time? I suppose that's as much as anything else what I'm interested in exploring. My skeptical sucker side. I have a newspaper here. There may come a time in the not too distant future when I have to work over these newspapers and bring their substance into this show, or some show. So I thought I would practice. Not that I will this evening, but I bring these papers up to see if there's some way for me to get inside these subjects and discuss them. So the top of... I've got the front page here. Budget hawk Rudman dies. Former U.S. Senator Warren Rudman has passed away. That's very big news here in New Hampshire. Very big news. But I don't know much about it and am not that interested. Warren Rudman to me looks like an astronaut or the president of the Vanilla Fudge Company. And here's a terrible story about this local coach. I don't even want to read it, but so much of the news is... You don't even like mentioning it. To mention it is almost... It feels... like it makes you filthy. These terrible coaches everywhere doing awful things to children. Who wants to talk about that? Not I. And here's an article... Monitor columnist fends off would-be thief. So apparently one of the columnists of this paper battled away a thief, and that's a front-page story. Let's read the first lines of that. 'Twas 5 weeks before Christmas, and all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a golden doodle named Brady. Golden doodle. I suppose that's a dog. Who's this?
Ein, fünf. Vier, zwei, vier, fünf, drei.
So, and please let me know whether you like this, whatever this show is, sound strips that Sean creates. And then, because I don't mind. I don't know what's happening a lot of the time, but that's all right. We just roll around, a ball going down through the pegs. It's fine, so let's get back to this fellow here. So not even a golden doodle named Brady, or anyone else for that matter, in the O'Shea family early yesterday morning. Meanwhile, Tim O'Shea was busy outside in his black spandex cycling outfit, throwing F-bombs and right hooks, wondering if anyone would call the cops as he pummeled the guy who had tried to steal cash from his car. I punched him 3 times in the side of the head as I'm screaming, "Someone call the police." And so that's it. I don't know. So there's a story about another reporter who throws F-bombs and right hooks and takes out early morning car thieves in his spandex outfit. It's a very modern story. And then here's the final story from the front page. It's Warren Rudman has died. And then it's spandex columnist defeats car thief with F-bombs. And then it's about Israel. Ceasefire gains steam. And it's a picture of two sad Palestinians carrying some picture along. A lot of the articles in here are written by the AP. It's like we're boarding a ship of some sort. So that's the newspaper. Oh, you know, there's one thing I remember. I've been reading Dickens lately, Charles Dickens. Not that I have to tell you it's Charles, but I will tell you it's Charles. Because it's nice to say his full name and not just call him Dickens. Charles Dickens. Which is it's an added layer of warmth. Just lets you know that I care about him and would like to pat him on the back and say thank you, Charles Dickens. So I'm reading David Copperfield, and I haven't read it in many, many years. I don't know how long. 30 or 40, as it turns out, 30 or 40 years, because inside it I find an old photograph. And now this is something that happens occasionally. I'll open a book that I've read long ago and I'll find an old photograph. This was some habit of mine many years back to like a time capsule, put photographs, because I had no photo album nor really any reason to keep my photographs in an organized large book, one of those photo books that people have that they pull out and look through. I never had that experience of wanting to grab my old photos and look through them, so I stick them in books. That only happened for 10 years. I don't know how long it was. I can't remember at all. In fact, I forget that I even have photographs. So if someone says, "Do you have photographs of yourself younger?" I say, "No, but I do, and they're all in these books in the shelves, but I don't remember that." So at any rate, I find in Dickens, in this Dickens, in the middle of David Copperfield, an old photograph of myself, and it's black and white, and there's a Ferris wheel in the background, and I look young, very young, and I'm standing there with a fellow. I remember his face, but not who he is. I don't remember our relationship, only that I felt warm toward him. He was a friend. On the back, there's a name, Neil, and a telephone number. But the name is written, the script is very feminine, so I don't think that the man on the front, who I have warm feelings about, but can't remember who he is, I don't think his name is Neil. Or else it's a woman who wrote his name down for me as though Neil couldn't write, but that's probably not it. So I'm looking at this photograph, and a number of things strike me aside from who is this Neil, if it's Neil, what was the nature of our relationship, were we friends, did we go to this fair together, why don't I remember, And this second thing that I notice, how happy I look. Very smiley, devil-may-care, jaunty, almost jaunty look. Give me the most difficult ride, and I'll ride it. No, nothing will stop me. Just a very daring ride-goer. And so very happy, and that also, I look at the vixen, I think, was I happy like that? Was I so jaunty? Was I so devil-may-care? Did I have such daring do that I would ride the most difficult ride with aplomb? And so there's that. I don't remember feeling that way ever in my life. And then also, on my left hand, I see the most enormous wristwatch. Just an ungodly large clock that I've strapped around my wrist. And I almost blush with embarrassment 40 years after the fact. And I think, my God, what am I doing with this great Big Ben clock on my arm? Now, that's one thought. The other thought is that I have long considered myself someone who has never worn watches, not even as a child. That even as a young boy, interested in watches and the mechanics of things like that, I never liked the idea of strapping one on. I don't like things hanging on me. Never liked extra gizmos and gadgets dangling off my body in any kind of way. Not really. So, there's many problems looking at this photo. But then I think to myself, I wonder if Neil, if it's Neil, the person in the photograph, would somehow have some insight in all this. Maybe Neil would have a much better memory about our time at the fair and would be able to explain to me something about our past, because it's often the case that we have these great blanknesses about our past that other people remember perfectly well. So this is one part of the story. So this happens, and what can I do? I used to wear great watches and go to carnivals, and I was almost arrogantly prideful about my abilities there, as though it was some remarkable talent to ride these small merry-go-rounds and whatever they had. So maybe a day or two later, I'm out walking along. It's a beautiful morning, and I get near May Merriweather's home. Now, she has this peculiar, very peculiar home. She's out in the middle of nowhere. It's a dirt road with rocky farm walls, and her home is almost on the road itself. She has these great fields all about, and yet the home is right close to the road. It doesn't even make sense. And then her driveway, it cuts down into the field, and then it loops back, this great U-turn, to the house. As though the driveway itself has somehow forgotten where the house is. It's pursued down, and it was, oh, there, it's back over that way. So I go there. It's an extremely long, unnecessarily long driveway. And a house right abutting the road. So you can walk by May Merriweather's house, and everything is on display. The windows are there. You could see her. I often see her in the window. I'll say, hello, May, and I'll just keep going. How are you doing? And sometimes she'll wave me in. For some reason, she won't say anything. Even if the window's open and she can hear me, she'll just wave. And oftentimes not. And often I'll take a glance and then I'll look away because I don't want to be prying. Just one of those houses that everyone's prying if you're even near it. And yet you're trying to walk down the road and you have to avert your glance. I think you know what I mean. So I'm walking by and I hear a phone ringing. And the first ring, I'm not thinking about it. And then on the second ring, I recognize it. It's an old dial tone, an old rotary phone. And so I say, May, as she's sitting there, and she's not answering it, of course. No one answers their phones anymore. She's sitting there, the phone is right in front of her, and I say through her window from the road, "May, you have one of those old rotary phones?" And she waves me in, and I go in, and we both examine it, and I lift it up, and I remark on how heavy it is, as you do, and I think to myself, "Well, this is, it would be very nice to use it, but who can I call?" And we think for a few moments, and she suggests I could call her friend Alice, who lives in the next town over, and she starts telling me about Alice's good qualities. She would be a very, very enjoyable person to call, even for someone who doesn't know Alice. And then I remember, well, I have my old photograph of Neil and the telephone number. And it's impossible, impossible that Neil can be there. He cannot be there, but I think, why, that should be the number that I call. Of all the numbers in the land, why not? And of course, it's in the old days code, Gotham 61820. It doesn't mean anything anymore, but I turn it into numbers and I dial it. And it's very enjoyable to make the thing go around and very heavy, and I realize my finger muscles, my old rotary dial finger muscles, are no longer in shape. And I like that I've noticed that. It seems an achievement to notice that my fingers have weakened. And the phone goes through, and somebody on the other end answers. It's a woman, a young woman. And for whatever reason, she doesn't want to get off the phone. I say, "I'm looking for Neil. I know it's very unlikely that he's there, but he's an old friend of mine. And do you know anyone named Neil?" And she doesn't. And she's had the phone number for 3 or 4 years. And then she's persistent. She wants to know why I've called this person from long ago. And I tell her that I'm interested in finding out why I was wearing this watch 30 or 40 years ago. Why I was so happy looking 30 or 40 years ago. And that I don't remember, it doesn't feel consistent to me. I remember myself as I am now. And this young woman says to me, "Why do you think you remember who you were?" And I suppose I thought I was who I am. And then it occurred to me, but I'm not who I was anymore. That whoever I was in those days is not who I am now, and I'm not allowed to remember that. In the same way that I don't remember who Neil is, I also don't know who I was. That I was apparently this person who wore large watches and was very carefree and jaunty and enjoyed rides, and was happy and light, and had no idea that at some point in the near future, he would completely forget who he was. He would change so drastically that he would never remember these qualities of himself that day. Going to take a sip of this. Now, I didn't turn on the Skype. I think that was part of the recording problem. I'm not sure. But if you have any questions, you want to say anything, why don't we do it in chat? Has any things in the chat, I'll respond. If not, I'll keep going. Or if you want to talk on the Skype, say it in the thing. Now, I've never watched the Knife Show. And thank you, Nora. It's very nice to share. You know, I think the reason that I'm interested in sharing it is because I don't. There's no other... There's no one else that I would go and tell the story of Mae Merriweather. So the knife show, I don't know. Oh, I think I know what you mean. Yes, but it's sort of like they try to sell you these wonderful swords and knives. Yes, you must have the... Yes. I love the language. A lot of the language of these things is what attracts me. This very muscular language and these qualities, this passionate desire these salesmen have to sell. It's almost the greedy drive of their desire to sell these products is absolutely delightful to me. It almost makes me want to become a salesman myself because they seem to enjoy it so much, trying to get you to buy these knives, that they work up this language and these attitudes, these feelings around these knives that they don't have themselves with their manufacture, and they know that you want to have a relationship to a knife just like that. It's yes, diabolical, but it's so persuasive, so vilely. It's hard to say vilely. Yet I wish it was easier because it's a lovely adverb, vilely. Oh, it's walk time. See you in a moment. Had a thought. I would have Sean go out and record a bit of audio, and then on the same night I would go out and record some audio, and then I would command him, I would order him to slice the bits all together and get a big wooden spoon and stir it up. So a bit of him, a bit of me.
Sometimes there's just nothing in the air. Just nothing. There's nothing between you and the stars a gazillion miles away.
It's simultaneous, somewhat simultaneous. We're both setting off at around the same time, the same really stunning evening. Sparkling.
I'm actually wearing two jackets. I don't think I've ever done that before. And it doesn't actually work. You can double a lot of things. Socks and shirts and things like that. You can't really double your pants. And probably doubling the pants is the worst of the double. Jackets would be the second. Oh, it is so sparklingly clear tonight.
Sometimes the stars don't sparkle or twinkle, and then other times they're full of glittering. It's winking away.
It's just amazing. And when it is so sparklingly clear like it is tonight, you realize how much congestion there generally is in the air. You don't know what it is, but somehow there is some kind of a floating dust above us, whatever it is, probably water molecules, chemicals, little bits of dinosaur dust, debris, shirts, balloons, pieces of old airplane flying around up there.
I should like to see all the stars simply turn off for a moment. Just to see how much light they're actually providing to the landscape.
There must be things trapped in the sky we don't know anything about. Large things. Wiffle balls.
Do they just illuminate themselves? say, here I am. Here I am. 10 trillion light years away. Or do they provide some small bit of illumination and in their collective show?
Well, there must be old balloon shards floating around up there. At a certain height, you know, the winds are so strong and things must not come down. Is that true? So I'm wearing two jackets and I'm thinking about really old balloons high in the atmosphere. It might be a two-jacket thought.
Make it so I can at least walk along this path. So it's very dark, but I can see something. Is that light from the stars, or is it from reflected light from New York City? China? Some sort of radiation that floats around.
I wish I could take a picture of this. And that brings me to a thought I had about cameras. I wondered if there should be a what you see is what you photograph goal with photography. And I don't know if there is, but it seems like that should be the goal of cameras, to capture as close as possible what the eye is seeing.
My eyes get worse every day.
So for example, I took a picture the other day of something that was in the distance, and with my eyes, which aren't very good, I could see a lot of clarity, detail of this little structure. It's very far away on a cliff. And then I took a picture with my iPhone, which, you know, how good is that going to be? It's really pretty good, but it's also really not pretty good. Somehow that's what we have in these modern days, like with MP3 music. It's really pretty good, but then if you listen to really high quality music on a really good sound machine, I'll call them, you notice how really not very good it is. So we have this weird stress of really very good and really not very good going on at the same time.
Any branch of the science is devoted to what we're all about, what we're after. I know people look into our most intimate and microscopic structures that we're being mapped at an almost atomic level. At all of the corners and little bits of our bodies have acquired names. But where are we going? What is our purpose?
I noticed the other day, and I don't know if this is universally true of toads, or just this one toad, but it made me think all toads have this. But a toad, an alive toad, a living toad, smells like a dead toad. Now, that doesn't mean I know what dead toads smell like, but if you actually handle a toad, maybe it's because they live underground with the death of the soil all around them. But they carry with them the scent of their own death. And it made me wonder whether everything does.
Is it not possible to look at us in a collective way and say, well, quite clearly, they're headed for disaster? Or quite clearly, they're making their way towards kind of enlightened utopia. And they're 60% of the way there. Here are the obstacles facing them. Here is what they need to do.
You know, so for example, if I had my camera or my telephone, I could hold it up to the sky and take a picture of this sparkling thing. and it would look just like this. But if I did take a picture, it would look like complete silly darkness.
The force and the power of existence is greater than that of darkness and death. So what is the science of the study for where we're going?
So I saw, finally, Moonrise Kingdom, the Wes Anderson Moonrise Kingdom. And what I always notice about Wes Anderson films is his attention to language and certain details and catalogs of details. He loves the details of systems. In this movie, he's very interested in the details and the systems of the Khaki Scouts, sort of a stand-in for the Boy Scouts, and the whole world of merit badges and the kind of pomp and circumstance, the quasi-military quality of the scouting world.
The problem was being a hermit, if that's what I am, that you don't talk to anyone for long periods of time. You're not used to it. So it's a peculiar situation I've got myself in. Doing a show where I talk, because most of my days spent acquiring the habit of not talking.
And whenever I see a Wes Anderson film, I always think, I'm always reminded of how he sort of greedily, he's greedily interested in these details, like a fetishist. He has a fetish relationship to language in some instances, and then a fetish relationship to objects. And in his films, it can come off really beautifully and interesting. And then the way that the characters speak, they all have their own formal diction. They're trying their best. He likes that old, it's almost a 50s kind of a language. He can set up in an ironic way the characters' relationships. An interesting thing about this movie, there are a lot of characters who could be bad guys. Bruce Willis's sorrowful cop, Edward Norton's efficient and officious khaki scout leadership, Bill Murray's almost cruel but too vague to be cruel dissipated father slash lawyer. And then the almost nervous breakdown mother character of Frances McDormand. All of them very, very edgy, but very, very sweet. There's no real bad guy among them, and yet they are all almost bad guys because they're going after these two young children who have fallen in love and run away.
That we could be so tricked. Not that we're tricked. It's a film, anyway.
But that the angle of his make-believe, which I think my own angle can be very similar, so maybe that's why I run against it somewhat. The angle of his make-believe is so visibly untrue and so irrelevant that it makes his stories basically unnecessary and just these kinds of treats of sort of language and of vision and of a kind of storytelling. But all the loveliness is in the details and the the way the film looks, the language, the way that the softness that Bruce Willis brings to his character. This softness, it's a feminine quality I associate with Wes Anderson. All of his male characters have this feminine quality, which is surprising because you don't see it much in other films, and you're almost mystified by what's going on. What are these characters? Why are they so gentle? But even Edward Norton, who somewhat stalks around issuing demerits to all the khaki scouts and cautioning them and warning them and straightening them up and checking them for violations, even he has this thoughtful female side where he's very worried about what young Sam Schakowsky, I don't remember his last name, the hero of the film, what will become of him.
Let's do Brave Remember. Sean heard me. I was listening to this song the other day when he came by, Breakaway. One thing that's very amusing about these songs from the 20s, they had a particular way about them. Music for a long period of time, minute, 2 minutes, it doesn't even sound like anyone could sing, but then all of a sudden they sing. Not for a long time, short singing. And then back to the music for a minute. Break away, get up and shake away. It comes, now you syncope. Some returns upon your heels. Oh boy, how good it feels. You get the happiest new sensation. Write a little note on your toe. Don't forget to dump that night. Look what you wrote, goodness knows. It's easy as pie. Come on and take away. Get up and sail away. You'll do the breakaway by and by. And then these tin can fellows, they all sounded the same. Tiny little tin can, narrow sound. But all these old, this whole slew, I'll say, period of time when that was the way that songs were. They'd be 4 minutes long. The first 2 minutes would be the music. Then the fellow would come in with a couple of lines, and then he'd be gone. And 2 minutes more of music. That was the old songwriting. As they transitioned away from simply just music, they let the singer creep in just a bit. It's almost like he's a soloist. A guitar solo in the middle of a song, the singer soloist. Well, I know we're getting close to the end. I don't know how close we are. I know he only programmed an hour. We thought an hour would be the right amount of time. I don't know if it is. We're back on the funicular. Let's say we're still going straight up into the sky. Straight up. It's not up a mountain. It's up into the clouds. Straight up. Nothing you notice, you see, ever see young lovers together in a slightly scary place, top of a building, they cling together somewhat. Well, in this funicular, in this gondola, as we head up into space, you sit, there's one chair, scattering of old newspapers on the floor, a few magazines, sense of other people. Their food, their things. It doesn't, smells like a very used space. But as we head, which is the compass direction that is up? We have north, south, east, and west. We should have a direction that's called up, that is not the word up. So we head starward. One thing you notice as you go up, if you're alone, and we are together alone in this going up, is you somewhat start to cling to the sounds of the thing that holds you. The little whir of the great metal rope, the windows as they rattle, the wind as it touches. You cling to it like those two young lovers cling together in their frightening situation. We use our senses to grab hold of things. To gain safety and comfort, we look, we listen, we touch, we put our hands out and put them on the wall. Our senses are our comforts. It's odd that we rely on them in that way, that they provide this sense of safety for us. And yet beautiful and very human. I don't know if you've had this feeling. Every once in a while, it happened a lot when I was younger, I get this very tight constriction in my chest. I have this situation of tightening of the rib cage or the ligaments or something. It has a name, costochondritis, I don't know. But it replicates a kind of heart attack feeling. But it got me to thinking. Every once in a while, maybe once a month, I'll have some sort of physical disorder. Trouble breathing or suddenly sweating. And, you know, you worry. Well, maybe I'm going to die now. Here it comes. And then it passes and weeks go by and you think, well, I guess it wasn't then. But it occurred to me, I wonder if there are points over the course of our life when we become, when we're very close actually to dying. I think that's the end of the show. Thank you, my friends, for joining me. I wish you a happy Thanksgiving. It was merry and bright. It's tired and I'm late. The old frozen fire turn out late. Tomorrow we'll slip through town, side every turn up thing down. But now it's time to sleep. It's tired and I'm late. Untie your candles, I just lit the skates. We're sitting in sleepless light, come dreams to a sleeping light. But now it's time to sleep.
Hit the ball now.
It's tired and I'm late. Your frozen fire turn out late. Tomorrow we'll sleep through town, side every turn up thing down. But now it's time to sleep.